Sir Isaiah is presently beginning his longest distinguished career at Oxford, where he's president of one of the newer colleges of Wall Street. And he is also a professor at City University of New York, where he conducts graduate seminars. Ever since the appearance of his book on Karl Marx, which was published a few months only before the outbreak of the last war, Sir Isaiah has impressed readers, those who heard him, with the powers of his mind and unique literary gifts. These are instantly recognizable, whether the subject selfless are Tolstoy or Stuart Mill, Alexander Herzen, or Herder. He is, as one quickly discerns from his book, unafraid of his preferences, which I should interpret are those of a liberal humanist, suspicious of metaphysical systems, openly accepting the difficulties which man and society must face to make his choices. At the same time that he's attracted to the liberal thinkers of the last century, he feels drawn to the great systems makers of the past, yet only to deny the notion of final harmony. This afternoon, Sir Isaiah will be lecturing on the subject of the Russian conception of the right of calling. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you Sir Isaiah Berlin.
First, I would thank the service for any kind of introduction of me, and then proceed to say what I was always saying to such circumstances, namely this, that I tend to talk very fast in a low voice, and people at the back, sometimes even in the front, aren't able to hear what I'm saying. May I ask people at the back, if they can't hear, and on the assumption they wish to hear, to signify this by some mild exercise of your behavior, by either raising their hands or something that means doing something to check my attention. If they succeed in doing this, I'll do my best to go more slowly and talk more loudly, though I can't promise that this will be a success. They'll do my best. I assume, mistakenly, that what I'm saying now can be heard in the back. Otherwise, my remarks are somewhat self-falsified. Can you hear it all right? Oh, no, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, let's pick up the subject of this talk. I want to talk about the Russian conception of the artist, which seems to me to have had a very powerful effect upon the West, not only Russia itself, but the West upon us all, even at this moment. It's what's called a highly relevant subject in many ways, as you will see. There is something paradoxical about Russia and ideas. After all, nobody will deny that the largest single event or phenomenon of the 20th century is certainly the Great Russian Revolution, which, in one way or another, has affected everyone for good. At the same time, it's difficult to say that even if you believe, however much or how little you believe in the role of ideas in history or the interrelationship of ideas in fact, it's difficult to see which particular ideas born on Russian soil precipitate this event. And indeed, further reflection leads one to think, and I'm about to utter a fairly sweeping generalization, which if it is untrue, I hope someone will point it out to me afterwards, that outside the realm of the science, where the Russians have, of course, produced men of reason, as much as any other great thing, in the realm of what might be called humanities or general ideas, no powerful idea which has affected mankind was born on Russian soil, not any. What has happened is this. There was a great impact in the West upon Russia. These ideas came filtering in a manner which I shall try and describe. But something does happen to them on Russian soil. Namely, the Russians do tend, or have tended in the past, to take these ideas extremely seriously. To take an idea seriously makes a very great resistance to ideas. They become, in the course of this, they become transformed. And in their transformed condition, they come hitting back, so to speak, at the countries whence they proceed, and other countries as well. It's what I should like to call a kind of boomerang effect. In this, when the boomerang comes winging back, it sometimes carries an appearance very different from that with which it began. In this sense, they do transform ideas, and transform them very powerfully. This, for example, happened to Russia with, say, the ideas of Darwin, which were simply scientific ideas in the West, but became an object of almost religious worship in Russia. It's what happened to the idea of the party, the Communist Party. The conception outlined by Marx and even by Engels, because it was taken with utter seriousness and ritualism by Lenin and by his colleagues, transformed itself into the situation, into an institution which its founders can scarcely have entered. And in this form, came back to Europe and to the rest of the world and has made a very great deal of difference to our lives. extent of the word. The idea which I intend to speak, which is the idea of commitment in Vipassana, which we find greater weakness, engagement or commitment, seems to me to be the product of the reigning in of certain ideas in the West and the transformation upon Russian soil and the re-emergence as a kind of Russian idea sometime in the 19th century. This idea came back to the West, and the impact of it has certainly made a very visual difference both to Christian and to writing and to the general outlook of life. To ask why there is a poverty of ideas on Russian soil, there are a good many reasons. Not, of course, that these are the kind of reasons which the scientists would give. It seems to me in this kind of historical explanation, even if you do give reasons, it's idle to maintain that even if you had known these reasons beforehand, you could have predicted the consequences. History is not a science at any rate yet. The history of ideas still less. Nevertheless, I think there's something illuminating about it. To begin with, you must remember that the great church schism divided Russia and a section of Southeastern Europe from the West, with the result that the great intellectual tradition in Europe, which is connected with the Roman Church and the monastic movement, never really touched Russia. The Russian Church produced its quota of holy living, of martyr, of sainted lives, but it has no serious intellectual tradition. The Poles who lived next door certainly had it, and so far as the Russians had it all, they caught it from the Poles fairly late in their history. But the fundamental tradition of the Russian Church is non-intellectual in character. It doesn't breed ideas. More than this, you could say that as a result of this, you have a comparatively uneducated population, a small upper class, a tiny ruling class, totally incapable of coping with the enormous problems which began to occur when Russia first made its contact with East and West and began to expand, particularly during the reign of Ivan VII. Everyone knows that what occurred was the great forward step made by Peter the Great, who was the greatest, most, in some ways, most brutal modernizer in the whole of history, who decided to transform Russia and make her capable of withstanding the impact of the West, so that he could beat the West. He sent his young men into foreign countries, he sent his young men to Germany, to Holland, to England, to France. They came back with skills, with art, with new languages. They became a nucleus of bureaucrats. The more they learned, the more Europeanized they became, the greater grew the chasm between them and the vast mass of Russian peasantry below, which remained in its old, dark, medieval, superstitious, poverty-ridden squalor. This chasm, if anything, is, I think, widened as a result of Peter, and widened still further in the 18th century. These Russian bureaucrats, who were sent to be educated west, and who spoke French towards the middle of the and end of the 18th century, really, some of them went through a traumatic and kind of feeling experience. They read Voltaire, they read Rousseau, they read Montesquieu, they read these people, they in some sense came into contact with ideas of the Enlightenment, the ideas of liberty, the ideas of light, science, which would put an end to superstition, prejudice, tradition, the dark, the heritage of the Middle Ages weighing upon them. At the same time, the notion of trying to transform this vast and ill-governed empire in accordance with the new sciences, new moral and political principles gained in the West was too heavy at once. The thing was too much. The average Russian landowner of the 1770s, with one hand read Voltaire and believed in all kinds of enlightened ideas, and with the other hand still whipped his serfs just as merrily as before. It was a kind of divided life, and not very good to have to their children. Some of them attempted to reform, but the weight was so heavy, even the Emperor Catherine was not entirely sincere, perhaps, when she tried to at least get the foundation to adapt the constitution to some kind of principles enunciated by Montesquieu when she invited Diderot to Petersburg and various German and Swiss scientists as well. Nevertheless, when it came to the point, the danger was too great. Winds of change began to blow in Western Europe, the French Revolution was beginning to ripen, the probability of destruction of law and order was too high. And as soon as this began to happen, a straitjacket was immediately clamped on the great empire. The bureaucrats tightened their control, if anything, and you have a picture of a small number of rather desperate men trying to govern this huge, unruly empire with a vast, ignorant, barbarous, or semi-barbarous population of peasants and ignorant church, without very much aid from outside. The kind of situation about which the French reaction is immense, but in the beginning of the 19th century, said that the worst thing which could happen was the liberation of the serfs. He explained to Alexander I that in Europe, at least, in the West, were two great principles. One was the church, the other was slavery. When the church acquired enough authority, they could, in their Christian charity upon his slavery. But in Russia, the church was ignorant. In Russia, the church was not respected. It was despised by everyone. It was chaotic. It was drunken in the villages. No one owned profound respect for the local priests. And therefore, the liberation of the serfs would simply be the end. The whole empire would collapse, and they would leave a period of barbarism only in order to enter a period of violence and new barbarism, permitting civilization altogether. Well, this is the kind of impression which intelligent foreigners sustained about Russia towards the end of the 18th and the 19th century. This is not simply the atmosphere. Nevertheless, what happened, of course, we all know, Russia kept out of the West as long as possible quantity. Politically, young men were allowed to go with small quantities. They weren't allowed to go to France much, which was regarded as rather too advanced in liberal ideas. They went to Germany, which was regarded as safer. But even there, they obtained a certain number of ideas which fermented inside them and didn't really, to the more sensitive and morally conscious ones, certainly didn't allow very much, didn't quite so conscious, didn't allow them very much moral rest. Then there was a great Napoleonic invasion, and the great Russian army marched through Europe in a big way for the first time in 1814 from Russia to Paris. This was an event of the First Order. Of the First Order because the children of the troubled Lazarus, for the first time, direct contact with the masses in the form of the conflict of peasants. No doubt they knew about their own peasants and their own estates, but the contact wasn't very wide. In an army, particularly fighting great. Is of course the fact that the Russians emerged from Europe. The chief contact with European culture at the very moment of the rise of the Romantic movement. Don't let me try and summarize the Romantic movement in 3.5 minutes, which is presumably what I ought to be doing now. Let me just say this, so far as it's relevant to this particular theme, that one of the central themes of the Romantic movement was the notion of vocation or purpose or function. That every group of human beings, nations, churches, cultures, indeed every individual human being, was not born to nothing. They had each had some part to play in the great world drama. Various countries, of course, interpret their various roles differently. But one of the hearts of the Romantic doctrine was that there was a built-in purpose, which the realization of which would expand the potential of a human group, say the Germans, say the French, or of some organized entity, say the Enlightenment, or of some church, say the New Protestant Church, would develop them in some sort of way in which they would release all the potential forces in an appropriate harmonious manner. This is the kind of doctrine which is certainly desirable to be born, not among advanced, but rather more among backward nations. These backward nations are, in a sense, feel a certain shame and embarrassment about their backwards. They are despised, they are bullied, and they are dominated by the advanced. This is certainly what happened to the Germans vis-à-vis the French. There were the French who were both materially and militarily, artistically, and in every other respect, the great dominant civilized nation of the world. The English, perhaps, only came second if left. There were the Germans who, since the late 16th century, had certainly, of course, had gone up in its conclusions or for whatever reason, had certainly been looked upon by these Westerners as a simple-hearted collection of half-peasants. Population, peasants, schoolmasters, grammarians, persons who hadn't done very much for human civilization, amiable but coarse, and certainly not participants in the great Renaissance in which the Italians, the French, the Dutch, even the Swedes had taken a much more prominent part. If, for example, you take the late 15th or the late 16th or the 17th century. This kind of humiliation always produces a reaction by which people say, can we be as bad? surely we have something which these others have not got. And the Germans came to the conclusion that the French were superficial, that the French didn't understand the inner part of life, that the French were not musical, and many things better. The Germans did. Exactly this dominated the Russians. Surely we must play some part in this world. They look upon us as great clod-hopping barbarians, mere brutal repressors of European liberty, a mere army which is coming crashing across Germany in order to restore Louis XVIII to France. But surely there must be something more to us than what these persons supposed to be. The first person who really articulated these doubts and these thoughts was a Russian guard officer called Sardaev, between 1859 and 1825, and he came to very pessimistic conclusions. He said, if other nations have a glorious past, what have we? We have nothing. Wandering tribes, after them, by Danzig, decayed by Danzig, after them, the Tatars, after them, the Poles, after them, disorder, nothing. Darkness, ignorance, brutality, the knout, that's our past. Why are we here at all? What part are we called upon to play in this great world? Perhaps God created us simply as a caution to other nations, to show them how not to be, to show them what not to do. Well, you can imagine, this kind of writing, this kind of breath speech, which then becomes an absolutely alienating thing among Russian intellectuals, this kind of almost exultant self-depreciation, and this painful inquiry about why are we here, where are we going, what is to be our future, whither, is this enormous country with its vast wealth, its enormous strength, its huge geographical extent, what is it, what is to become of it? This kind of problem then becomes, of course, a regular thing of offense. Almost every conflict of intellectual. Sardaev, having uttered these regular sentiments, was promptly declared mad, and a doctor was attached to him. He was not allowed to leave his house. A regular act on the part of government of this type when faced with this kind of declaration. It becomes national from that day. So now, no. But he did start all the scenes which then became the reverberation. And as a result of this, the young, to some extent already brought into contact with the West, filled with shame and agony about their both intellectual and above all the moral and social condition of their poor brothers, the 95% or so of the population, began to look for some ways of remedy, which in some ways would take. You must realize that censorship was harsh, dangerous ideas of the West were not really allowed to get in, and this also created its own cipher. Take, for example, Paris, where many ideas struggled to express. Paris was in the 30s and 40s, was filled with ideas largely born of the failure, of the relative failure of the French Revolution, explanations why it failed and what we should do in order to obtain those ends for which the thought of revolution fought, or on the other hand, of those who thought the French Revolution was a disaster and how much it stopped its dreadful radical effects. There are a great many conservative, liberal, socialist ideas teeming in Paris, certainly. Great many ideas by Saint-Simon, by Cournier, by the young Proudhon, this kind of atmosphere in which to which Marx came comparatively early in his life, in the early 40s. Where you have an atmosphere where a great many ideas struggle for expression, no one of them usually acquires an absolute blinding domination. They form a kind of field of force which they knock against each other and simply, in a certain sense, inoculate each other. So you have a general field of force, but no domination. Russia was exactly the opposite. From a young nation, fresh and young, a new generation of young men being educated at the now standard universities, even the Russians realized that for the purpose of coping technologically with the West, a higher level of education was needed, and so the universities expanded, persons not of noble birth began to be admitted. These persons, both these young noblemen and others, lived in an atmosphere of comparative intellectual vacuum. Now, when you have a situation of oppression with immense agonized eagerness after knowledge, hunger after knowledge, nostalgic yearning after the truth, which is somehow or other the churches have failed to provide, certainly their traditions have failed to provide, you have that. Any idea which comes wafting across, God knows how, in the false bottom of somebody's suitcase, the senses haven't been able to find, through the oral repetition by some young Russian who's been buried in the Brussels, or some center of Western culture, who then reported what he has read or what he has heard, these ideas acquire an enormous vitality and grow out of all recognition of history because they haven't very much. And if you have a censorship as well, which prevents these ideas, they acquire the force of disapproval, which of course makes it even more effective. With the result that these ideas came wafting across in the West and blew to enormous size and power among the Russians. Moreover, because political and social thought were in effect forbidden under the repressive government, they found their way into what were regarded as paper channels of literature and art. With the result that literature became automatically social. That is to say, people who would normally have become social or political pamphleteers wrote novels of poems. And people who would normally write novels of poems became social or political pamphleteers. The thing is, it became two. but it was only outlet of a huge pent-up indignant, exasperated desire to find some solution to our problem, to discover what to do, how else to live, and so forth. The voice which really articulates all this was then the Christian Kaczynski in the 40s, the late 30s, early 40s, he was a man of humble birth, and therefore having self-experienced some of the traditions which we were public matter of social political discussion in the title of the modern Brandenburg. And he was a man of such sincerity and passion, such immense integrity and purity of life, that he had a very dominant effect upon his own. And it's really he who, in a sense, created this particular movement. Now let me explain what he believed and what people wrote. As I say, the natural field for this was art and literature. Now he could take it away. The normal view, I'll call it the French view, but it's called the wild simplification, because we're getting part of this particular story. The ordinary Western or French view was that art was simply a product which you possess. You were an artist. The public expected you to produce something. You were like a carpenter. A table was ordered, you made the best table you could. You were a composer, you produced the most beautiful work of music you could produce. You were a writer, you wrote in the most beautiful words, placed the best order about the most view into the subject, and you hoped that you were talented, you were gifted, you would extend your book, your composition, which is gorgeous. Not, of course, the rule of the event. You saw the artist as a kind of sacred instrument for the purpose of spreading inner soul of the world, some kind of inner reality which the gross eye of the ordinary critical observer could hardly detect. But in Russia, simply because the number of the enlightened of the world was then led to what was called intelligentsia afterwards was law, these people felt that they were, in a sense, the only people who could talk to each other freely. Whatever you have a situation where you have political repression and an oppression in the dark and the tyranny of the church, you always have a certain solidarity among the liberals, solidarity among the enlightened, solidarity among those who can read and write, solidarity among those who cannot make it better. These people began to feel that they had a certain responsibility to the weaker brethren, the responsibility of any man in public to tell the truth. Now, on the French view, simply surveyed and obviously invaded and attacked to the audience, the public, and the but in Russia, the idea that art was an object was regarded as trust, because that meant that in some way you were compartmentalized. You said, as a writer, I write. As a composer, I compose. As a man, what do I do as a man? I may begin from the place. As a writer, if I'm Goethe, for example, I may pity poor Gretchen in Faust and represent her as an innocent victim of Faust wrongly condemned to death. But as the advisor to the Grand Duke of Weimar, I may sign a great many death warrants of girls performed exactly the same crimes as Gretchen without any qualm. This was, man is one. And what he says with the whole of his business. You cannot divide your deeds inside to say, as a father I feel this, and as a writer I feel that. As a citizen I feel this, and as a painter or as a composer I feel that. This is a view which is genuinely different from that of the average Western writer. If you said to, I don't know, to Stendhal, who discovered that I don't know, of the German government. He wouldn't have regarded that as relevant to the excellence or otherwise of his novels. If you had discovered, even if you had discovered, I think, that Dickens took rack rent from the poor at the time of writing his most moving novel, perhaps it would have done something to weaken his reputation. But the merit of his novels would still have been regarded as undiminished by this. This wasn't so in Russia. When Herzen said, the Russian literature, the famous Russian revolution in the 19th century, said, Russian literature is one enormous indictment of Russian life. When the writer Korolenko, in the speaking of the 20th century, second or third rate novel, short story about it, said, my home is not Russia. My home is Russian literature. This meant something quite clear to the Russians. It meant that Russian literature, which is the literature ultimately of criticism and of virtue, a literature which tries to defend human rights, a literature which in some way expressed those ideals which were not largely not to be powered in the particular life around them, that was the true home of a writer who thought that about censorship and to men. It wouldn't have made any sense. I mean, you can't imagine very naughty saying, England is not my country, England is not my country. It wouldn't have made any sense even for Henry James to say, America is not my country, American literature is. Nobody would have known what he meant, and indeed wouldn't have said. But in the case of Russia, it's very plain what this means. Because literature did become the only escape valve, the only sense through which the exasperated wound of feeling was born. And for this, it is largely already preached unity of theory and faith in some cases ago. He didn't plead for propagandism, he didn't plead for utilitarianism, he merely said that it is the business of a man who is in public, which if he has the temerity and the courage to speak in public on the public platform, he testifies to something. He testifies himself. And it is in fact, since men are not islands, and since they are largely shaped by certain social forces and live in a certain kind of society, inevitably, if he tells the truth and tells it at a profound enough level, the social implications of what he says will become big. There's no need to do it deliberately. All his life, despite the constant breaches of the social obligations of the writer, he kept on emphasizing the fact that it was no good merely reading ideas in books and then putting them into art. This wouldn't make him live. The argument was that if you lived in a society and didn't want to run away from its reality, then what you said inevitably reflected the reality, whether you meant to do it or not. And that is what all great writers in some sense did. Shakespeare did, that Schiller and Germany inspired all these writers, and even the cold-hearted Goethe, try as he might, nevertheless conveyed the whole picture of contemporary German life, which is why philosophers and other writers, and so many quotations of Goethe's our work, in some sense, even a kind of encyclopedia of German history. Any man of genius, in that sense, reflects anything which passes through what we used to call marrow and blood. Above all, he preached, on the one hand, non-detachment. He said that those who ran away from the German reaction, or those, on the contrary, who submitted to it and said, life is terrible, but we haven't made it that way in the Chartreuse, we might as well accommodate us. These never produced work on the side of death. The people he admired were those who, as he said, were sons of their time, sons of their country, knew where they were, understood the social situation in which they lived, suffered it in their instincts, in their feelings, in their innermost necessities of their heart and mind, and then generated works of art because they had talent for imagery, because they had talent for writing. Without talent, without images, nothing would happen. To say of literature, he says, is interesting, true, important, but not artistic. He's paying it no compliment. This is, roughly speaking, the sermon of this preacher, whose own augmented life bore evidence to the sincerity and depth. He started off by preaching the philosopher of Fichte, which on the whole, in his case, he implied the attempt to rise above the darkness of everyday life into some empyrean. He then abandoned this for the philosophy of Schiller, which reached the necessity of resisting tyranny, resisting oppression, and in some way making literature a vehicle of indignant truth. He left there. His life is one long series of zigzags, painfully born, because every time he changed his view, he did it in an agonized way and tried to live it. Hegel, who in some way, for him at any rate, preached reconciliation with reality, so that once you understood why there was no tradition, once you understood why Philip II was concerned, once you understood why Peter the Great, a great many people with his own hands, once you understood why Nicholas I had to keep Russia in the trade jacket, because the common people, if they were allowed anywhere near ideas, would become intoxicated by them and go to smash everything up. Once you understood this, you were reconciled to it. To understand is to understand reality, to understand that there is a great pattern of the universe, to kick against which is a form of childishness and immaturity. Well, this is the reaction you do, and we didn't linger in it very long, because being a morally very sensitive individual, he revolted against it. In the end, he said, whatever Hegel might say, he was not prepared to put up with every cruelty and abomination of history, simply because some higher harmony demanded it. It's all very well for higher harmony. But for us who live below, this is less convenient. It may be that discords are necessary for some higher harmony, but those who are doomed to instantiate these discords in their personal lives, they cannot be expected to appreciate this particular point of view. And so he ended up with a kind of, how he ended up, in a kind of bourgeois liberal index. But this, I think, is relatively unimportant. The point is, each time he tried to live his philosophy in the most passionate way, however many friends or enemies it might have made him, and this, in some sense, created a moral image for other Russian writers of what critics really do. Let me try to explain that this is really the birth of theory of social criticism. There were, in a certain sense, social criticism in the early economics, but in some way. For someone like Van Burgh, for example, the great French critic, social criticism means knowing about the milieu of the writer, whose parents were, where he went to school, what the social situation was, which was brought up, what the religious, social, political views were of his time, how it enters, and how, what sort of way it works. or someone like Schlegel, the social physicist in Wien, the perception in great works of art of the most typical figures of that time. He looked in Shakespeare for the most rich and full-blooded representation of an species. He looked in Cervantes for the richest and most developed kind of humanity in the space of time. He looked in Dante for something similar. And therefore, social physicism is simply the ability to create out a kind of idealized image of the most typical, the most characteristic, the most important, the most interesting being, artificial compounded, of any age, any time, and in what way it expresses itself culturally, in what way it expresses itself socially, in what way it expresses itself morally, and of course, it's not the difference. The identity is the father of the sense which he's a father of the is he really believes in the identity of the original, as an archetype, with all the problems. When, for example, he reviews the Vicar Wakefield by Gilbert, which he must have read in the 17th French translation, 17th edition of a miserable French translation, which is regular English, and not much for a French. He says all very well about the Vicar Wakefield, but he's represented by Gilbert as a kind of saintly character on the edges of life, who takes no part in action at all. The wicked people are people who act, the virtuous people are people who don't do anything, are simply buffeted about by life, vicky, innocent, unworldly, rather sweet, but simply rather impractical victim of the moralistic of life. But this is a terrible thing. We can't accept this. This is anti-activist philosophy. The morality of this implies non-action in some way is holier than action. It implies that contemplation or some kind of Christian meditation is more important than active adherence and identification with such causes than the full exploration of all my talents to the service, whatever I regard as some inner ideal of my life. As I'm a condemned for the God Wakefield, even if this was a tremendous piece of moral propaganda of the wrong kind. Well, this, of course, is exaggerated attitude and doesn't tell us much about the Vicar Wakefield. But it indicates the kind of criticism, when he reviews 15th great novels, he takes them up in the series, he says, Maria Nikolaevna in chapter 1, and says this to me. But in chapter 14, she no longer says that. It is not possible. The kind of character that Maria Nikolaevna, as we all know, must be such, therefore, the author is doing something immoral here. He's trying to catch the reader's sense, he's trying to play with the reader, he's trying to affect the reader's nervous system, he's trying to simply excite the reader, he's trying to tell something to the reader, he's not telling the truth, he's not going sufficiently deeply into the subject, this is a form of using art, simply as a form of amusement, or using art where still has been profit. This is entering the market. This is the worst form of non-integrity of betrayal, which a man attempting to tell the truth and profit about his being, this continues to take upon his soul. This was roughly the kind of stuff which he addressed to his contemporaries, and it enters very deeply into the heart of even the most literate and even the most artistic among us. Let me tell you, for instance, that this is a real case of whom act. This problem of what is the purpose of art, is it to enter the social function, or on the contrary, is it out of our state, was something which was raging in Paris in the late 30s and early 40s. Various persons, St. Simonius, for example, and more than others, maintained the purpose of art was fixed attention. Art for our sake is a movement that was born as a protest against pressure upon the artists by outside forces, by the church, by the state, by the bourgeoisie, by the market. Well, Stanley Morgan, but rather more intolerant, has maintained that whatever you said, in a sense already conveyed your personality, as was in some sense, whether you knew it or not, a false equation. Therefore, artists might as well realize that our work has to be. They might as well become conscious that everything has a certain effect on others, is in a certain sense propaganda. And if it is propaganda, you might as well be aware of what it is and direct it towards the course, namely the realization of sensibilian ideals. Against this, there arose someone like Georg Gautier, the well-known romantic poet, Dominic, who said this is a foul of social doctrine. To try and make of art something useful is abomination. A poem is not a theory. An epic is not a railway system. A novel is not a pair of shoes. Metonymy will not keep the rain off when you walk, not an umbrella. No, a thousand times no, says, by the powers of all the folks, dead, living in the future, let me tell you that what you are saying is absolute nonsense and rubbish. Cretins, fools, 10,000 times no. Well, this is a very famous introduction to Mademoiselle de Maupin, and it was the great manifesto of your art. This argument between people who believe that art has a social tendency, people like the writer John Stars, and people of her particular circle, and against the art for art's sake, romantic, like Good Day and his friends, this raged from the 1930s to the early 1840s, and ultimately fizzled out. By the 1860s, not very much of entertainment. But in Russia, it took tremendous root. And there it really did become the origin of the entire school of Russian fiction. Let me take someone like Dugin, who is regarded in the West, certainly, as the most artistic, the most pure, the most lyrical, and in a sense, the least political of all the great artists. Dugin was certainly in love with art as art. And he certainly adored the learning nature. And he was always saying how little he was to be, in a sense, involved in the painful and tragic problem of the day, but he couldn't avoid it, and he didn't try to avoid it. When he wrote On the Eve, for example, about the Bulgarian Revolution, still later, when he wrote his famous novel Father and Son, Father and Son, which the central character of which is the sinister nihilist of us, who despises the whole of jubilating aesthetic civilization, who believes that only science matters, who is like genteel living as such, who shocks and horrifies both his friend, the student, and the student's father, and above all, the student's aesthetic uncle, by the violence and the rudeness and the undisguised hostility of his radical sentiments, which says that more or less detecting frogs is more useful than reading the works of Pushkin, the rough speaker. Of course, we want the truth, what we want is science, and not all this self-indulgence and pretty poetry and the aesthetic embellishment of life. When he wrote this, a storm broke over his head. It broke over his head because the young thought he had caricatured them, and the old thought he'd idealized them too much. This is what invariably happens on the part of anyone who seeks to tell the truth in careful terms with a certain degree of unbending integrity with which the Turgenev certainly had. He might have answered all these criticisms, I mean the old criticizing for putting Nazarov in a sentence, for suddenly producing this rude, violent, nihilistic, revolutionary figure with his hatred of the Tsarist regime, hatred of liberal life in general, of glorifying him, of making him sinister, but at the same time wildly attractive. The large, gigantic figure, much bigger than anyone else. The novel puts everybody on the shade. The young, of course, said that he was much too horrified. That they didn't pretend that it wasn't part of their intention to destroy the whole of the past. In a way, Indians getting a job, which can help the police and the government to fix a new label. A new label on the students they didn't like to call them nihilists and punish them for every fire that broke out in Petersburg and for every accident that occurred in Moscow. They being a deliberate piece of the revolutionary activity. Turgenev didn't retire by saying, I am a novice. I simply describe the place what I find. I'm not tempted here. I'm not preaching a sermon here. So why are you all against me? I'm simply trying to tell the truth. I'm not for a thing. I'm an honest man describing the life around me. He did not take that time, and couldn't have taken that time, with Vilinsky's eye upon him. Vilinsky was dead by 1848, before the novel was published. But he was a great friend of Turgenev, and the moral influence which his image had was something indelible in the life. There was this severe stare which called them back to some sense of integrity and truth, and above all, forbade all forms of invasion. Invasion above all, from forecoming social danger. Turgenev tried to send it from him. He said, the answer you would take it. I adore them. I didn't share his views on art, because they go just too far. But in every other respect, of course, I'm on his side. And there was endless effort, endless large number of people saying, how could they have been taken with them? How could they? After all, I tried to make them the place to play once again. I'm entirely against the Tsarist system. I'm one of the people who, in the novel, most in the area, most instrumental in destroying the Tsarist system in Russia. Of course, I'm on the side of liberty and progress. Of course, I hate it. Of course, I hate this complexity. On the other hand, his old friends with whom he went shooting, around in the States, have become a different line. He said, well, of course, what the radicals were doing was essentially considered dangerous. One understood why they were doing it, because, of course, the cities they were at. And Russia was in a terrible condition. Nevertheless, it was clear that our girls were utopian and our methods abominable. Well, I'm not, for the moment, trying to defend Turgenev, who, in a somewhat difficult fashion, he tried to defend himself both ways. The only point I was to make is, he didn't wish to escape and say, art is art, what has it to do with politics? Why do you? I'm describing, how dare you suggest that I'm influencing people, that I take a side? Of course I take a side, one can't help you. In every sense, you write, your business is shining forth. It's not possible to neutralize oneself to such an extent so far above the battle as merely to produce a so-called objective description which doesn't for one single moment betray the right of their name. Yes, I have an attitude, and if you want to know what it is, I'm against revolution, I'm against the reactionaries, but on the other hand, I hate the reactionaries, and I fear the reactionaries. Very comfortable, but mine. This is roughly what's going to change. I think I believe in gradualism, I believe in the system, I believe in hurrying things, in chaos, the violence will destroy civilization by which we live. On the other hand, if the present system goes on, then of course the revolutions will multiply, the danger of a collapse will become imminent, and the country which is such a reactionary and this abominable state of Europe will deservedly collapse on this system. Well, that's the beginning. And that was the least. The first thing that can be dreamed of them all, as the purest example of an uncommitted political art. The man about whom he said that he was a man more ecstasy than anyone had ever met. The man who was looked on by his friends in France, by Robert, by Beaupassant, by Zola, as the most perfect artist they'd ever met. Certainly, the view of Turgenev as a writer of harmless idiom. Of simply reading accounts, briefs of thousands of the Russian countryside, of the Russian peasants, of the Russian squires, is the normal view of the period propagated in the West. It's inaccurate because it calls every single one of his novels, the bigger novels, has a central political view. It's always concerned with Russia and Paris. Let me now say this. One of the characteristics of Russian literature, simply because of this, of course, because they're so aware of their backward position, because they're so aware of how undeveloped they are in relation to Europe, and it fills them with embarrassment, shame, and a certain existence of our conceptions of what's always happening in this situation, whether the people are Russians or Asians or Africans or whoever may be in this situation now. For this reason, the whole of Russian literature is deeply narcissistic. The only literature which is so comparable with it, I should say, was American literature, that is it, but not quite so much. All Russian novelists are about Russia, and about Russia too. You see, the question of whither Russia, the famous attempted problem, what do we do about the third system, what do we do about the Tsarist system, what do we do about corruption, what do we do with arbitrary punishment, what do we do about the horror of this reaction regime, it preoccupies more in one way or another than in the corridor of history, but they think of it well. It was very odd to Balzac didn't say wither France. Reynaud seemed to be saying wither Hampshire or Wiltshire. This is the wither lady. Maybe Zane did come rather near saying wither America. He was right in that sort of way. Well, it is typical of the Russians, and typical of Turkey, and typical of these neighbors of Turkey. The same thing is true of Tolstoy in a very different way. If you take Tolstoy, for example, he's a man who's not against his style. He's a man who, on the whole, despises history. He thinks that the problems are successful, and that the symptoms of social problems is ephemeral, or are symptoms of social problems that ephemeral problems are important, is fundamentally wrong. But even for story, he's deeply affected by the notion that the novelist has made a contribution. And if he fails in it, he fails in it as a man, and there is no desertion. Man and the novelist. You can't say as a novelist that you're one thing, as a man another. How dare you ask me what I do as a man? None of your business, which is producing Western writers at this particular time. I produce novels, you read them. I produce poetry, you read them. What I do at home, my relationship to my king, my wife, my money, is my own affair. Don't you dare interfere. This is not a position of any of the major Russian writers. So Tolstoy has four criteria for what makes a good novel. The first criteria is that he would write well. Well, that's the thing that he would write. And for Tolstoy, the thing is writing fairly and good. If you do that, what you write is good. If you do not, it's good. The second criterion is that the problems about which he would write must be of general human importance and not political. They must be trivial. They must turn themselves with what men in general are facing in this society. Great evidence. The third criterion is that you mustn't write about what you yourself have lived through in some fashion yourself, either in experience or by nature. And you mustn't say, because this is the job to give, you mustn't say he came in with a sinister expression on his face. Because sinister is not a description of it.
people be scared of this. You mustn't say separate, you mustn't ask the reader to fly with the camel to fly also. In other words, you mustn't ask a text, it must all be done at your goal. You must be quite clear that everything that you are writing is something for which you have some corresponding theory, either because you've lived through it or because you've imagined it, in full concrete sense. You find that, for example, the variant of one of the famous stories, for example, of the Murat, where these images are always being made more and more concrete, also supporting the speech. But first, they need to remove that heat from the water with a slight hissing sound. Then comes another image called the final image. They move that heat from within the mud at the bottom of the screen with the sound of the flopping of books. So we have to be completely this is very bad thing. The fourth criterion is that you must understand where the moral center of inspiration lies. If you don't understand that, you are behaving immorally. Now, in the sense, of course, of story, the big kingdom of difference. And one of the reasons for choosing these criteria was to do down the three most important writers in Russia in their day. I say this because he didn't actually look down. I don't think it's murder, but it's an awfully plausible case he did. Take, for example, the first criterion about the criterion about the importance. Well, I think he did. Very strange for me. And he knows all his life, more or less. He says, Turgenev is a Protestant writer. Nobody can deny the writings for prose. Moreover, there's no doubt that he experienced everything he writes about. All those rising country houses, he gets to how he is. And all this love of pretty women, he gets to what he has experienced. And all these melancholy and sweet thoughts are in the gesture which are part of his head. But they are of no importance, they are trivial and peripheral. Who wants to know what decayed Russian noblemen think of decayed Russian country houses? What honest workmen, what honest peasants will give suffer for the thought of this decayed, melancholy, self-destroying, self-seeking, neurotic, or they didn't call them their collection of peripheral things, so down this a bit. The next person are the question of the fact that you must have suffered your government to be. And if you take the class of the great story of Russian woe of the third teaching, of course these problems are terrible. He's quite right, he's writing about the dark wounds of our society. Nobody can tell him. A marvelous, useless, and effective. Unfortunately, he has nothing. He's a surf owner. He won't liberate his own surf. He's done from outside point of view. And there's not a slightest reason for thinking that he himself suffers anything when he does it. And this is true of other writers as well. Goethe suffers nothing when he writes by Faust. Too innocent. And that was just the reader as he could. Flaubert is a marvelous writer, you will say. But take, for example, Paris Julien, not defending. The story of St. Julien, who kisses and breaks the leper, and is then the leper is Jesus Christ, and the Julian is taken up to heaven. This is the most moving and important religious story, how it's used to them, and nobody can say that the scene is trivial in any way. The only point is, when you put into Flaubert, supposing Flaubert is facing the situation, one has a certain hesitation in supposing that Flaubert would have behaved quite in that way. And this is this undermined confidence. This is precisely what he said about Bernard Shaw, who tried to fuck up in every possible way, but who refused and said he was a superficial man, right, to produce all these silly jokes, feels nothing, suffers nothing, there is nothing to read. This knocks out the castle and quite a large number of other things. The final, of course, case is writing well, which is one now, who can say anything by something else. Profound problems, and agonized over everything, unfortunately, can't write. After the first 200 pages, all the characters are on the stage, the whole thing is then gone through the rest of the scenery and within this program. Well, this is it, by the way. The point I'm making is not this one at all, of course. The point that I wish to make is that Tolstoy also felt deeply the fact that the story had to have some kind of moral center, otherwise it would be no good. He adored Maupassant. He adored him more than any other great writer ever adored anyone, and not altogether satisfied. There's a reason he made it start. And take the story about Maupassant, where a little girl, the daughter of a prostitute, a lot of men come to see her mother and make merry, and the little girl is deceived by all this laughter and drunk, and then when she says her mother then reveals her possessed little girl, who is seduced by one of her mother's lovers, becomes a prostitute herself, and that's the end of the story. And Maupassant says, this is stupid. Apart from the immorality of the story, which of course is a flaw, apart from that, he says, according to the writer. Some form of hideous creature of the difficulty, which a man, a man, is not allowed to do because it is a form of lying. The lying out. This is Tolstoy's moralistic criticism. Of course, it's part of moralistic criticism, but I wish to say that here is Tolstoy, who fundamentally hates the point, who knows the risk, who knows the revolution, who knows the idea that you can improve the country by act of parliament, or by revolutionary action, or by social sentimentalism. But in everything lay entirely within the spiritual center of the individual. Cannot only, but when he actually comes to criticism, uses the very criteria of integrity, of truth, of what matters, of which he affects criticism. And this applies to the elves, applies to the elves. It even applies to the symbolists. The symbolists know what they know as real life. But even they, what Pity and Pity is lying about Typhon, hearing it to some unknown, through the midst of spiritual experience and so on, deep spiritual values, but then it's simple to somehow interpret and reproduce. But still, they were obliged to tell the truth, whatever it is that he has heard, he has written. There was no question of writing for enjoyment, writing for fun, writing to amuse yourself, writing to excite the reader, writing for a thousand and one reasons which people have written. This was by them and by every Russian of importance was regarded as frivolous and treacherous. Finally, this is doctrine which, of course, has gone on entirely. In the Soviet Union, he's taken much more utilitarian and much more propagandist form. This, of course, the writer of my piece, he stood in his denial, because he thought that people will tell the truth. Of course, the truth must be in your blood and your marrow, and you will tell it because you can't stop it. But the idea of writing according to the book, or obeying the instructions of the state, the first party, was to them a formal form of betrayal of your calling. And that is why, when you do get this individual of the job in the Soviet Union, let's say Dr. Zhivago, this is exactly in the I don't see something that is actually a kind of monumental work, but even a purely imaginative novel, like Zhivago, of course, as far as not really, contains a lot of in favor of salvation by art, by grace. He is in favor of a pure individual not crushed by what he calls postmark time. He's against the provincial dreams born in a pure little country, against the vast revolution. Spelled out in the fullest possible. And that is why, quite correctly, the critics of Novelia criticize him as his obsolete. And they criticize him as you from earlier times. This is not nothing to do with the revolution. And he was criticized, for example, by relating to Deutschland even more harshly than the Soviet. He was criticized him for not bringing in the important things that happened during the revolution. For example, where was the fourth party country? Where were the important decisions were made by the central committee. Well, that's rather as if you said, by Dickens, or maybe the first enough novelist, why is there nothing in Dickens about, about the Durham Report? Why is there nothing in George Eliot about the First International, Karl Marx? Why is there nothing in Shakespeare about the Reformation? Why is there nothing in Shakespeare about the Dutch Wars? Why is there nothing in Dickens about I don't care what this is a case of my dear, I don't care what you would like to say. It's very plain by the result. This is what he was criticized for. Nevertheless, it was perfectly right in the sense to criticize. There's no doubt it stands in the truth of social criticism in which even the most imaginative works are regarded as in something. The entering through the narrow and the largest divisive causes of the writer himself, of the deep experience of the time concerning which he must in some sense testify. And it's a view which is directly antiquarian to its opposite one, that of what I call the French of thought, namely the view that the artist is simply the creator of something, of a silver pot, or let us say of a silver bowl. You want a silver bowl, I create a silver bowl. It's no business of yours what my message is. It's no business of yours who I am. As Mr. Eliot, here's Eliot says, art illuminates by its own inner radiance. The writer, the biography of the writer, or his attempts to motives are set to be written. This is exactly the point against which the whole of Russian history, the whole of Russian history, has strained for better or for worse from the day of which they spoke until the present day. And this kind of criticism, this is all these things we've heard about from communists and dissenters, any other types of criticism, or compared to this, then it's root in Russia, in the history. You have to interpret it in a different situation. in the writings of Lucius Pierre Leroux, who is one of the Pennsylvanian Protestants, happened to be a friend of Lord Broad, was the cross as one of his ideas, takes root in Russia and springs into enormous size, which then proceeds to cast its shadow, for better or for worse, over the rest of the world from then on. Thank you very much. Thank you.